Hello and welcome to Answer Me This. Thank you for listening.
If you've just heard some ads, please know we do not control which commercials you get to hear.
But now they're done, here is an episode of Answer Me This.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
Hello and welcome to Answer Me This. Thank you for listening.
If you've just heard some ads, please know we do not control which commercials you get to hear.
But now they're done, here is an episode of Answer Me This.
Is Boris's true ambition to be king of the planet?
Answer me this, answer me this.
Why is Ottolenghi's food all garnished with pomegranate?
Answer me this, Helen and Ollie, answer me this.
Now, last episode, we were considering how many people catch a bouquet at a wedding and then actually get married as a direct consequence.
Have loads of people written in saying, I caught the bouquet, and as a direct consequence of that, wouldn't have happened if I hadn't caught the bouquet, I got married.
They haven't, although well, even if they had,
funny that.
I'd be dubious, because I think there has to be a clear statute of limitations here.
What is that?
Well, I think, really, you've got to say, did you catch the bouquet and then within a year become proposed to? I think if you're saying, yeah, I caught a bouquet and 20 years later I met the man of my dreams, I mean, you might as well say, yeah, everyone who catches the bouquet will at some point die. Anyway, it turns out there is more than meets the eye to these misogynist bun fights. Wayne in Cambridge has written in to say, I recently attended a wedding where the bride threw her bouquet. Before the event, though, there was a lot of talk amongst the female half of the wedding party about fixing the throw.
No!
Controversial, isn't it?
Why?
I know. This is the kind of thing that should never be made public, Wayne.
You're the Edward Snowden of bouquet throwing.
They wanted to fix the throw so that one of the bride's sisters caught the bouquet. She wanted her boyfriend to ask her to marry him, and they thought that if this sister caught the bouquet, then social pressure would force him to pop the question.
Because that is such a romantic reason to ask someone to marry.
Social pressure.
Social pressure.
It's the thing people always say, isn't it, in the wedding speech. First met across a crowded room, but it was really social pressure that brought us together.
Yeah, we'll never look back. And also, if this man is not inclined to propose anyway, I'm not sure the bouquet toss would make him think, oh, actually, I've had a complete about turn.
There was a lot of planning, continues Wayne, and the bride let fly. Unfortunately, the bouquet flew straight over the waiting girls.
Ah, didn't plan properly, did you? You should put it up a net or something.
And into the arms of a young girl standing at the back of the hall.
Did she get married?
Yes, well, someone now must obviously marry her, because that is social pressure.
Can't leave her hanging.
I must admit, says Wayne, that I thought the idea of them trying to fix a blind throw was quite amusing.
Well, listeners, I know you've been waiting on tenterhooks since the last episode of Answer Me This to find out the results of who's got better legs from knee to foot,
okay.
Ollie or Martin.
Can I just say, before you reveal the results, and I genuinely don't know, you've been collating the data, right?
Yes.
Okay, Martin, do you know? Do you have any idea?
No, I don't know. Okay. I haven't heard.
So the audience have been impartially voting on who they think's got better legs. But may I just say,
oh, no.
And I'm not criticising you, Helen, I'm just saying it's a fact.
It's not a good photo.
The photo you put up of our legs, although I'm happy with the way my leg looked in the photo and I think is representative of the shape and definition that I am proud of in my legs.
Yeah.
I don't like the fact that the picture includes our feet, because I'm just going to concede now, if I've lost, Martin does have better feet than I.
Oh, thank you.
I wasn't saying that I had good feet. I was saying I had shapely legs. I was very specific on that point.
Right.
I think some people are voting for Martin because they like his feet.
That's nice, actually, and I appreciate that. I mean, looking at that photo, I thought both of our legs look pretty nice, actually.
No, I've got better legs than you.
Oh, well, I know you would say that, but you won't.
If you want to see this photo while I deliver the verdict, go to answermethispodcast.com/legs. People have said such things about your legs as, I wouldn't kick either pair out of bed. Very flattering.
That's nice, thank you.
I'd have both.
Who just likes to have pairs of legs in bed with them, detached from the bodies.
It's a bit Louis Bunnell, isn't it?
I'd have both and lick golden syrup off either. Saucy.
Really?
Neither are good, but the leg on the right is the best of a sorry pair.
Well, fuck that guy.
Left wins best ladies, right wins best mans. So I can reveal now that the legs on the left belong to Martin and the legs on the right belong to Ollie.
See that shapely definition. And by the way, I wasn't tensing to people who say that I'm tensing
sure.
And trying to show off definition. That's just natural muscle that's there.
Yeah. You haven't had implants or anything.
Exactly.
But you can get them. They are a procedure. No.
Martin's the one who's just got an absolutely straight leg.
I've got a picturesque line, mate.
It's like Heather Mills is standing there with me.
I'm like a fucking Coke bottle.
Do you want to hear who is the winner?
I think the world wants to hear, Ellen.
There was a 60-40 split in leg preference. And the winner of the leg off, Ollie's legs.
Wow.
But a lot of people like the right legs. Are they Martin's?
Yeah. Isn't it interesting that I think people maybe voted for them because they thought they might be Martin's?
Yeah, and they didn't like your foot pose.
You gave really bad foot.
So, as I say, I'm not claiming to have better feet, but yeah, I'm glad that the audience has voted for my legs impartially, and they're right. They're right to do so.
So, which body part do you want to compare this episode?
I think ballsack is the obvious next step.
All right, I'll post a photo answeringthispodcast.com/nothanks.
Hello, Helen and Ollie and Martin. It's Rebecca from Letchworth. Please, please answer me this because it's been bugging me for ages. What breed of dog is Gromit from Wallace and Gromit?
He's a beagle.
He is a beagle. Is that? Did you just?
I thought he was a beagle.
That was a guess.
Did you realise the ear shape and the snout? Yeah. Actually, what are they still doing? Because I haven't seen any of their work since Curse of the Were-Rabbit.
Which was great, wasn't it?
I can't remember.
It was dead good, that, I think.
I think I went with our friend who had just broken up with someone, so he was quietly crying around the screening.
Okay. At the storyline, because there's obviously a love interest
there. I don't think he was paying attention to the film.
Okay, that's a shame. But what they've been doing since then is a couple of spin-off, like BBC series for kids.
Yeah. Some of them are animated, like normal drawn animation, aren't they?
Well, of course, the problem is... I mean, and Nick Park's been quite open about this.
They've, it's time-consuming.
Exactly. They've always refused even offers from American telly for millions of dollars to make a proper, you know, 10-part, 30-minute series or even a 15-minute series because it takes so long that that would be years of work. It's not worth it. So the series that they do are kind of like teaching kids about science or something like that. So you get like a 2 minutes worth of Wallace and Gromit and then, you know, actors or cartoons or whatever.
What does Wallace know about science?
Well, he's an inventor.
Yeah, but he's
a bit ramshackle.
An idiot. Yeah.
You know, he's a try it and see if it works kind of
he's
guy.
He's not an idiot. He built a rocket in his back garden that took him to the moon safely and back again.
Yeah, but he thought
he's
the moon
an idiot.
Was,
That's something that took NASA years.
Yeah, but he ate part of the moon, Martin.
Well, of course you would.
Yeah, you see, Buzz Aldrin probably did as well. You would, absolutely.
Where are the crackers, Neil Armstrong?
But the other thing they've done, actually, is they've opened a ride at Blackpool Pleasure Beach.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
the bleakest place on earth.
Yeah, if anything was going to get me going back to Blackpool, it would be to ride the Wallace and Gromit ride, which looks decent. It costs £5.25 million to build.
Okay.
I thought you were going to say it costs £5.25 to go on. I thought that was a very odd way to say that.
It probably is about that. It's more like a sort of Disney ride in that, you know, it's not got many thrills and spills. It's a slow moving ride around the history of Wallace and Gromit told in animatronic form.
That's cool.
Sounds fun.
Actually, they could easily have a Legoland style Aardmanland.
Totally.
That would be quite great.
It would be good, yeah. Yeah, but again, I suppose more expensive and time-consuming than simply licensing your brand to someone who's going to develop one ride for you. Here's a question from Drew. Helen, answer me this. Why is sleep often referred to as kip? As in, I'm going off for a kip.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is how that word is used.
That's right.
Do you use it naturally? It's not one of those slangs that it's unacceptable to use because it's so put on. It's like you're in a Guy Ritchie film.
It's one that we
would say
something
a
that
bit.
The Cockneys say that we would say too. God bless them.
Kip is the great leveller. Kip is also the unit of currency in Laos. I was interested to read. And it also means the hide of young animals. But it used to mean a tavern or a brothel, places where you would go and lie down in a bed because taverns, people used to stay over in them. And eventually it just came to mean the act of sleeping that you would have done in those places. Lost the meaning of having sex with prostitutes.
Generally, but I suppose euphemistically people could say I'm going for a kip with their partner and actually that's really what they're up to.
Yes.
You know, excuse themselves from a party. Time to get some kip, ho ho.
I don't think you'd go for a kip at a party.
I don't mean literally as the party continues. I mean, I was imagining dinner party here where you're staying over, for example. Or, you know, you're in a hotel bar. Time to get some kip, but actually you're going to go upstairs and fuck.
I think that's an incidental
application of it.
Yes, of course, yes.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes, kipping can still mean that.
Yes.
You're like, oh, I'm off for a kip, and then you go down to the nearest whorehouse.
You've got a question. Email your question to answer me this podcast at googlemail.com. Answer me this podcast at googlemail.com.
it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Here's a question from Rick in Manchester who says, I was lucky enough to receive a gift of Kendall mint cake from my mother-in-law recently.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah.
She must like you.
Apart from tasting pretty vile, he says, it doesn't really taste like that green mint stuff growing in my garden either. So Helen, answer me this. Do they use actual mint in the production of Kendall mint cake? And if not, what the frig is it?
It's peppermint oil.
It's an extract of mint, presumably.
Yeah, exactly.
So, whoa. How do they make that? Because I ask this because, for example, I use chili oil on my cooking.
Yes.
Here's how I make chili oil.
Chili and oil.
You put some chilies and some olive oil.
No. In January, I go to the Christmas sales and I get a half-price Oaxaca gift selection of chili oil.
You're a winner at life.
Which you can buy in Boots for £10, but in January it's a fiver.
I only eat things I buy in Boots. She says, frothing at the mouth.
Yeah, it's great. If you just drop a couple of Nurofen in, it's delish. But anyway.
Baraka for pudding.
And then I top it up with olive oil throughout the year so that my oil becomes infused with the chili that's in there. But I didn't know if what it was really right from the beginning was just olive oil and chili. Is that really all it is? There's no essence going on. They've just put some chilies in some oil.
Well, there's capsaicin, and that's a waxy substance, so you need an oil to draw that out, really.
See, I had no idea what he just said. Is what he said's right?
Oil got chili in it, Ollie.
How do you make mint oil? Do you just put mint in oil? That's my question.
No, it's a more sophisticated process to extract the oils that are in the plant.
So it's like the oil that comes off on your fingers when you rub the plant together?
Yeah.
Right.
It's the extract. In fact, Kendall mint cake is a very pure product. The only ingredients are sugar, glucose, obviously that is refined.
That's sugar, yeah.
Water and peppermint oil.
It's all sugar, though, isn't it?
Yeah, basically. And did I mention sugar?
Yeah.
A fuckload of sugar.
Yeah, but and water, healthy water.
It's almost impossible to avoid water in foodstuffs, isn't it?
It's possible, actually, that people listening to this around the world have not heard of Kendall mint cake.
Right.
Because as parochial, disgusting foodstuffs go, it does travel.
I mean, of course,
but probably most of our listeners in the USA, for example, won't have heard of it. So,
well, it's like tablet outside of Scotland isn't really available.
What is tablet?
Tablet is like Kendall mint cake without the mint.
Oh, God, even worse. What's it, just sugar then?
Well, it's sort of like fudge, but I think a bit less condensed milky.
All fudge can go fuck itself.
You've made your feelings on fudge known before.
It's worth saying
again.
And
the fudge is busy fucking itself in the corner. Kendall mint cake is like...
Oh, yeah, that.
It's like a little brick made out of sugar. It's like a peppermint cream, if you've ever made one of those.
Yeah,
or like fondant
that.
Out of the middle of a cream egg that's gone hard.
And the branding was very clever because all along they've sort of suggested that it has medicinal qualities. They say if you're stuck up a mountain, like in Kendall, where it's from, then you can have this sugar boost. And that's the branding that still now people associate with it.
This is because it's a very compact source of calories. But when Sir Edmund Hillary did his successful expedition to the top of Everest in 1953... he took Kendall mint cake with him, and after that it was the mountaineer's celebrated food of choice.
But, you know, I don't know. When Olympic swimmers won their gold, they came to the podium wearing Beats earphones. Yeah, it doesn't mean the two things are connected, does it? It's just product placement.
Here's a Kendall mint cake fact that I think you will enjoy. In New York, customs banned Kendall mint cake because they said a product called cake had to have cake in it. And so...
Keeping America safe.
A shipload of Kendall mint cake was dumped in the Atlantic in the 50s.
No, really?
Yeah.
Was that the famous Boston Kendall mint cake party?
The New York mint party.
And yet they're able to sell Coca-Cola there as a vegetable drink. I mean, this is the ridiculous double standards.
Other fun Kendall mint cake fact... it was one of those foodstuffs that came about by accident because in 1800 and something, someone was trying to make glacier mints in Kendall, you know, those clear boiled sweets, and left it on the stove too long and it turned into Kendall mint cake.
Yeah. But then presumably, obviously, at that point, didn't have chocolate wrapped around it.
No, chocolate is a later addition to the canonical mint cake.
But do most of them now get sold with chocolate around it?
No, there's white mint cake, which is made from white sugar, brown mint cake, which is made of brown sugar, and then chocolate-enrobed mint cake.
Here's another question of cake now from Amy and Simon in Ealing. They say, during our recent holiday to Cornwall, we had 4 afternoon teas.
On one day.
Yeah, I think not knowing how long you were there for is, you know, make it difficult to judge whether that's just excessive. So, Helen, answer me this. Who eats all the leftover cake at the end of the filming of The Great British Bake Off. We were defeated by even a small assortment of cakes and scones, despite both of us having that's right, I say scones.
Yeah, I say scones.
Deal with it.
We're scones people here.
Despite both of us having large appetites, we just couldn't manage it. Simon thinks the crew eat the cake.
Makes sense.
But in the first episode of the new series of The Great British Bake Off, there were 36 tiny cakes per contestant, and there are 12 contestants.
36 times 12.
Is it 432?
I think that they give the cakes to the stately home. So, Helen, answer me this. Who eats all the cake?
Crew. The crew there is massive. It's over 60 people. Mm. Because you've not only got the normal TV crew of, like, producers, assistant producers, researchers, runners who've been sent to the supermarket to pick up more ingredients, sound, light, makeup, people doing the washing up, paramedics, health and safety. They've got 6 cameras, which is a lot for that kind of show. Mm. They've also got home economists on the team because they need to be backstage, like, checking everything works. Like, you've got to have people who know how to make TV programmes and also people who know how the food works. They're also filming over a weekend. So there are dozens of people working. I reckon they could get through those cakes. So I think the greater question is, how do Paul Hollywood and Mary Berry face eating, like, the contestants, they're making sort of 3 different challenges each. So how do they face tasting 36 or more cake samples? She's tiny. How does she eat 36 cakes a weekend and stay so slim?
Do you think she's got cake bulimia? Is that what you're saying?
No.
It's possible, though.
No, I think she's just got mind over matter honed to the extent that the cake is not going to dare stay on her bones.
Is it like whiskey tasting where they just spit the cake into a bin afterwards?
Yeah,
if
probably.
It was, I'd rather watch that.
Mary Berry shooting cake at a target with her mouth. Yes, that's what the spin-off show presented by Joe Brand should be.
On the one hand, I can see the argument that it's a great temptation to be around cake all weekend, be filming cake and thinking, oh, I want a bit of that. And as soon as it's finished, you're going to think, right, I'm going to eat that bloody cake now. Yeah. On the other hand, actually, if you're around that much cake, it probably loses its lure, a bit like working on pornography. You know, people say
that.
Same,
isn't it?
Yeah,
you
no
don't want to eat any
cake, cake
when you're working on pornography.
Exactly.
It's dirty.
Do you know what I mean? You're not in the mood for anything sugary.
Well, I find when I've been cooking a lot, I don't want any of it. Mm. I just want to be far away from it. Mm. Maybe because the smells already create the experience somewhat.
Well, some people who work in a sweet shop, you know, tend not to eat sweets for fun.
Well, because otherwise they'd be dead. But I just don't think it's that implausible that most of the cake would get eaten and some of the crew would take bits home and some of it would get thrown away.
And some of the contestants would take bits home. You know, you've just been there all day. You want to say, Mum, this is what I've been doing this weekend. Try my cake.
The contestants must eat a bit of each other's cakes so they can slug them off backstage.
I mean, they've been through an auditioning process to see these are people who are really into cake. You know, of anyone, if you're going to choose a sample group of people who might want to eat cake after making cake, it's those people.
Imagine if you turned up and they said, so, do you like cake? And you went, that's all right.
Yeah. Now, you're actually getting into this series of GBBO, as I refuse to call it, because I'm not a prick.
G-b-b-o.
Yeah.
Well, I've only seen one episode so far, but I've forsworn it the previous few series because I like shows like Ace of Cakes, where they're making a massive, really intricate animatronic cake.
Yeah.
That's difficult. I could not do that.
Correct.
Bake Off, hitherto, they've been making just ordinary cakes. And I think, well, where's the mystery in that? I'm capable of that. Whereas now they're doing things that are a lot fancier. And I think, all right, they've got some game.
Cake for me is something where I don't want the mystery explained. To me, it's a bit like The Masked Magician. You know, I want cake to be a thing that I casually eat. I think, fancy a bit of cake now. I don't want to think about the work that goes into it. That doesn't make it taste better to me.
No, to me, cakes and also close-up magic and stunts are not diminished by knowing how they're done. If anything, my wonder only increases by knowing the process.
As with all of those cases, you want to replicate the process.
I'm very good at stunts.
I personally can't bear the show. I mean, I've not sat and tried to watch it properly.
Is it all the pastel colours and the bunting?
It's the unbearable mock drama
lightness
of it all.
Of being. The unbearable lightness of baking. That would be a good alternative
and
title
and
for
the
it.
Awful music. There's this piece of music that crap TV uses, which is just like one chord and boo, which is meant to generate tension.
It's the tension.
And it's so
and
annoying.
I don't have any tension.
No.
You know, Will Clare's brownie, right? Don't care.
It's just a brownie. No one's going to die.
Yeah, exactly.
Brownies are easy. It's living that's hard. Apparently, Mel and Sue, they're keeping an eye on the contestants because they can get a bit blind to the task they're doing, which is just making cakes. It's not important enough to cry and have a breakdown over. Mm. So if someone's looking a bit breakdowny, they'll go up to them and swear a lot so that the footage of them talking to them doesn't make it onto the show. So it's like having a private conversation but in the middle of this live shoot.
That's a good technique. Have you ever bought something specifically because you've seen an ingredient be used on a cookery program?
Absolutely not. If anything, that would make me think, too predictable.
It's over.
It's like when I was a teenager and I was like, I'm not going to listen to music that other people I know have heard of.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing with Great British Bake Off now being on BBC One. They're talking about it in terms of the Delia effect. You know, yeah. when Delia first used cranberries, they went off the shelves or whatever, or, or North Wales sea salt.
There was an omelette frying pan that disappeared off the shelves. Yeah. They're saying this year, the
PR person for the Great British Bake Off is saying this year.
Dried raspberries, is it?
Freeze-dried raspberry and strawberry powder.
Powder.
Yeah.
Because apparently the first time they had to get freeze-dried raspberries for one of the contestants, they had to pick them out of a box of Special K because you couldn't buy them in isolation.
I mean, I suppose it's nice that it does widen people's experience of how they cook, but it is kind of a bit sad that everyone wants to do it just because it's been on the telly all at the same time.
Everyone wants to join in, though. Everyone likes to join in with things.
I don't.
Apart from Helen, yeah.
Oh, surely you'd want to be a part of Mary Berry's lemon curd surge, though.
Is that the after watershed version?
She used it on her TV series, apparently, and there was a surge in lemon curd purchasing.
Curd surge.
Curd surge. Hashtag curd surge.
Well, I'm no longer so worried about rising sea levels. On that delightful note, it's time to take a little tea break with today's intermission from Answer Me This, episode 169, available along with all our other archive episodes and albums and stuff from answermethisstore.com.
Angel says, regarding the waxworks in Madame Tussauds, Tussauds pride themselves on almost 100% accuracy.
If they could breathe, they would be real.
But Helen, answer me this. Does that mean Tussauds mould everything, even the genitals?
Oh, yes. And after normal opening hours, you can go back there and they take all of the statue's pants off and you can have a little go.
I wonder if that would increase corporate bookings, you know, if you could sit astride Johnny Depp. I know that with men, they have a special uniform mould where their private parts would be so that the trousers hang properly.
So every celebrity in Madame Tussauds has the same sized penis.
Yes, Michael Jackson, George W. Bush, Johnny Depp, they've all got the same number.
That's a wonderful sort of...
democratic...
utopia, isn't it?
Isn't it, yeah.
Where everyone's just the same, same size penis, same size balls.
It's less interesting than actually seeing the true variety of shape and
the
size.
The diaspora,
and...
if you will, of celebrity genitalia.
Well, stick this in your pipe. It's a question from Skype. Someone has dialed Answer Me This using Skype. Or equally, they could have called us. If they had, the number to do that would be this.
02081235807.
And let's see what they've said.
Let's hear what they've said, Ollie.
And let's hear what they've said.
It's David, originally from London, but now in ridiculously sunny Moscow. Last night I went to see a wonderful ballet production of The Nutcracker, and it left me with a fairly, I suppose, obvious question, which is why did ballet develop as an art form? I mean, I can understand how we went from spoken stories to written stories, things like plays and films and obviously TV and podcasts, but how... did ballet in itself come about as an art form?
A lot of things happened, David, before people had telly to entertain them. And this is just one of those.
Yeah, but it still goes on now, doesn't it? People are very into their dance. Not many, it has to be said.
Well, that's the thing. It is marginal and it's so expensive.
But
generally.
It's, well, okay.
And it's so difficult to do.
Aren't both of those things slightly untrue, though? Like, it's marginal, sort of. But then if you look at things like Cirque du Soleil, which are the biggest tourist attraction in Vegas and tour their shows all over the world.
And not ballet.
Or you look at something like So You Think You Can Dance or Britain's Got Talent.
Not ballet.
Well, you say not ballet. There are elements of ballet incorporated into it.
Elements?
Yeah.
Elements.
So it's not completely like marginalised and uninteresting to people. Uninteresting to me, but not to most people. Or like Cats, for example. You know, massive musical, but really a dance musical with a lot of ballet style movement
but
in it.
But ballet style is not ballet. Yeah, the purists are not going to be happy with Cats.
Well, and also, I take issue with the fact that you say it's expensive. You can go get a ticket for Sadler's Wells, can't you, for £25?
Yes, but then you're watching something like Matthew Bourne, which I have watched in Sadler's Wells for £11, but ballet purists again will be like, oh, there's a bit too much jazz in this.
I've seen a Matthew Bourne thing as well. I saw Play Without Words. You see that one?
Seen that. No, I saw The Nutcracker and also Sleeping Beauty.
I've not seen The Nutcracker. Maybe I should go and see one of the traditional ones. I know that he puts his own spin on it,
but very at least not it's traditional.
But at least the music is recognisable. Whereas Play Without Words, that was a play.
Right, and without words.
And I just, and its lack of words just made me drift off a bit.
Yes, well, here's the thing. I always feel like ballet is beautiful and impressive physically, but it's a language that I don't speak.
Yeah.
Which is a bit of a shame. My thought watching it is, wow, I could never do anything like this.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Very obvious.
I'm going to play devil's advocate on this one.
No, but also, is it worth it for those dancers to devote so many decades of their lives to training when they might not make it and physically ruining themselves, because dancers have a lot of joint problems and bone problems.
Art shouldn't be about technique. If you want to see good technique, you can go watch athletics.
Why shouldn't art be about technique, Martin?
Because it's about expression. That's only one component
of it. But can you express without the proper technique? This is what a lot of people would say about the abstract artists.
And you've just made a good comparison there with gymnastics. I actually weirdly love watching gymnastics on the
me
telly.
Too. Yeah.
And maybe that is because I understand it.
And it's not actually, trying to tell a story.
Yeah, but actually ballet is. So actually I should love it more because I love watching bouncy people being bendy.
In fun costumes.
And so why not do that whilst they're also telling the story of the Capulet? You know, but somehow I don't relate to it. I know that there are people who are listening to everything we're saying and think we're Philistines and we don't understand. You're probably right, but I sort of don't care.
Anyway, ballet and opera kind of sprung up at the same time, which was 15th century in Italy. It was like a spectacle in the courts. Noble men and women had pretty much fuck all to do. And so they would watch and participate in these big extravaganzas, which included dance and music and poetry. And I think even painting at the same time. And Catherine de' Medici thought this was so amazing. When she married Henry II of France, she launched ballet there. Like, she was funding ballet for the French court. And it was meant to be based on the social dances of the courts, which is why there's a lot of, like, these rigid upper arm movements and very set patterns in which they move. And then it became, like, a social requirement. So the nobles were all learning how to do it. And, in fact, Louis XIV, he was a major player in ballet because he danced a lot of the roles himself and made it hugely popular.
Bet he was a bit shit, though. Bet compared to, you know, if you were having a meritocratic auditioning process, he wasn't really that good.
Yeah, but if you could get beheaded for not casting him, you probably would, wouldn't you?
Well, the same thing happens with celebrity casting now, doesn't it?
Yeah, just get a good support cast.
Lindsay Lohan, fine. You know, we'll get someone from the RSC to play her husband. Be all right.
Yeah, with Speed the Plough, they just need an understudy that is never ill. Because that, in fact, this is the best understudy role there has ever been. Even better than understudying Martine McCutcheon in My Fair Lady. Your career is going to be made off this.
If you do find yourself watching a ballet and you do find yourself
if you just wake up and you're like, shit, there's a ballet right in front of me.
How did I get here? If you're there, how do you keep yourself entertained in a boring theatrical event?
Well, it's not necessarily boring, it's just,
well, let's say it is,
right? But
I'm asking you,
even if it isn't, like at gigs, especially
yes,
gigs where there
sometimes
aren't words,
yes,
I do tend to drift off.
Me too.
And even if I'm really enjoying a gig, I kind of want to know how long I've got to enjoy it for.
Exactly. So what do you do?
Well, often I plan patchwork in my head. I went to quite a boring Bill Callahan gig at the Royal Festival Hall.
Please,
it was really tedious.
Why is it so boring?
Oh, it was
every,
like,
song turns into like a 15-minute jam with the worst guitar solo you can imagine.
This is why Barry Manilow was good. 3.5 minutes in Out, Change Your Costume.
Yep.
Still take Bill Callahan over Barry Manilow.
He didn't change costumes once. But I was planning patchwork the whole time.
I do sometimes think ahead to my week. Because I'm someone who tends to diarise, paper and pen diary, I've got a file of facts, so I can visualise it. I don't need to get my phone out of my pocket. If I'm very bored and someone's doing a song that I don't know, I can just think, I can actually visualise. I've got Thursday on the right-hand side of the page. What's happening after 4 o'clock?
God,
where am I going to get a coffee?
Everything is wasted on us, isn't it? it really depends, though, on whether I'm sitting down or not. If I'm standing up and I'm bored, I just am only thinking about how I hate the world and I want to go home.
But even shows that I like that have a ballet bit.
Yes.
The ballet bit is the boring bit. So, like, for example, A Chorus Line, which we went to see at the London Palladium.
Oh, yes.
Everything was beautiful at the bat. Fucking hell, it goes on forever. So boring. And so during that bit of A Chorus Line, the rest of the show I completely enjoyed.
I thought they did that number very well, actually, and
still
I hate
did it
that
well,
song.
But it's ballet. During that number, I actually tried to visualise all of the songs that I remembered from A Chorus Line and tick them off.
That I can do.
Yeah, I thought, what's left? What's left to come? And I was like, oh, it's all right. What I Did for Love is around soon. How does that one go again? Let's see if I can remember the tune whilst I'm hearing the tune to this boring one.
I think the odd thing about that particular experience was that we were sat in the front row because they hadn't sold very well in a massive theatre.
We could see up the gusset of The Chorus Line.
Well, sweaty gussets. And also you could hear all the thumping, because part of the attraction of ballet is it looks like these people are defying gravity.
Yeah, you're absolutely
when
right,
you
yeah.
can hear this kind of thump, thump, thump. It changes things.
It did.
And I know that you can't help it, because that's what humans jumping sounds like.
Mm. It wasn't much of a promotion, because we went to the Palladium, it was half empty. Their tone was almost like, well, congratulations, you've got the cheapest seats, but you're going to be in the front row. You know,
neither
well,
of us
moved you to row AA or whatever it was
neither
called.
Of us ever want to be in the front row of anything ever.
Exactly.
They might ask us to come on stage.
That would have been a comedy gig, they don't go, so what are you in for?
That would have been a novel twist on the format of A Chorus Line, wouldn't it, if at the end the director said, actually, you're all shit, I'm choosing you. Light onto the theatre.
Put a leotard on and dance, dance, dance.
It would have brought new meaning to the word singular sensation.
The Silicon Roundabout's my favourite place. To become a webpreneur would be really ace. Like that awesome guy, Tom, who was my first friend on MySpace. We haven't kept in touch.
Get your foot on the ladder to online success. Through Squarespace, build a site and get a free web address. Then hang around East London until you get hired in the US.
Mountain View is calling. Google have free buffet.
Well, I know what you're thinking. Such beautiful music will surely compel me to design my own website. You'd be right to think that, and you'd be right to head over to squarespace.com, try their 14-day free trial, and then if you like what you see and you want to buy a year's membership, enter the code ANSWER to get 10% off.
And I'd also like to say thank you very much to Squarespace for funding this episode of Answer Me This.
Oh, yeah, they're good at that as well.
Have you decided what you're going to do with the money?
I am going to buy myself a Vivian Westwood hat.
I think that's going to be a bit over now. I think the backlash has started against hat.
Well, I can only afford it in the sale with what Squarespace are currently paying us.
It'll come around again.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what? The other day I did a gig and it was expenses only. And I left before the expenses were apportioned out. So the gig booker messaged me afterwards and she said, give me your address and I'll send it to you. And I said, buy a scratch card. And if you win, split it. She won 20 quid.
No, she actually did that.
Yeah.
Who would do that? Everyone would think, oh, she said buy a scratch card. I'm keeping that fiver. But she actually did it.
Yeah. Because she profited as well.
Well, yes, but she could have lost.
I was willing for her to take that risk with money that I hadn't expected to get anyway.
Yeah, but my point is, if I was her, I don't know if I'd be willing to take that risk with money that I'd said was yours, but actually I could keep for myself.
Well, anyway.
Well done her. Well done you.
Yeah. Squarespace is not that kind of risk, by the way. You know what you're getting, and it's a reasonable price for it.
That's right, yeah.
Be happy.
Yeah, indeed.
But maybe I'm going to reinvest my winnings in scratch cards, what, and a cycle of doom will be perpetuated. Here's a question from Nervous Husband in Thailand.
Is this definitely not spam? I can improve sexual performance with bank transfer degree.
Nervous Husband says, my pregnant wife seems to have grown a second pair of nipples just below her armpit.
Strong first sentence.
Wow.
I'm in.
It's not even finished yet, which also appeared during her first pregnancy, along with a third set of nipples on her midriff.
Wow.
That's six nipples altogether.
Her body is making sure that a baby can find a teat at almost every possible angle on her torso.
Very resourceful.
Convenient.
Next one's on her nose, I think.
Nervous Husband says, Ollie, answer me this. What is this multi-nipple manifestation all about?
It's all about the mammary ridge.
Mammary Ridge.
Sounds
I think
like
I went camping there once.
Yeah, exactly.
Just by the Alps, isn't it?
The mammary ridge is the part of the lady going down from the breast to the groin, which is kind of the milky pathway, really. It's the bit the milk channels through across your body, and as you get pregnant, that's the bit that gets larger and more developed. And that's what leads to breasts getting larger. But sometimes, and quite commonly apparently, up to 6% of women get this.
Wow, I've never heard of this before.
Well, because people don't want to proudly discuss
that around,
it. Exactly. Yeah.
I don't know. I'd imagine there are some pretty bawdy websites devoted to this very phenomenon.
Apparently it can just sprout a nipple anywhere along that ridge.
Amazing.
So your wife, Nervous Husband in Thailand, has actually, it's sort of unfortunately really, this has happened to her not once but twice, and what the percentage of that happening is, but it's possible it could carry on happening.
But it just becomes like a whole nipple field.
A nipple superhighway all the way along that ridge. And it is just to make sure that your milk is going to get to the baby, basically.
That is amazing. But are they functional, though?
Oh, they are. But obviously it's encouraged to use your real nipples rather because there's more milk there than in the ones that are just the little stops along the way.
Yeah.
It's also possible, if we're being truly Cronenbergian about this, to develop an ectopic milk duct that leaks milk through your skin without any visible breast tissue or a nipple at all.
It's like that's much cooler.
Milky stigmata.
Yeah.
Here's a question from James from Watford, who says, whilst browsing the internet for places to go on our upcoming holiday to Cornwall...
Loads of places to go.
He could go on four T's.
Yeah.
I noticed that Barnoon Cemetery is number 8 in TripAdvisor's list of top tourist attractions in St Ives.
Mm.
What are the other 7? I thought that maybe people with relatives buried there had contributed to this.
Well, they certainly have contributed to the cemetery. Just maybe not to the reviews on TripAdvisor.
It's big society, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that after going to a funeral, I would review the funeral service.
No.
That's just me.
Possibly not.
But it seems that people have actually reviewed the cemetery as an attraction.
Call that a grave. 1 star.
The rides were rubbish. One person said that they visited St Ives just to see the cemetery Another went off on a strange tangent about a James Bond-related epiphany.
It's almost as if people who review things on TripAdvisor aren't necessarily the best representative of ordinary people and their experiences of things.
Unbelievable. Now, I appreciate that not all of the West Country's tourist attractions can pull the crowds like Devon's Barometer World, but... Wow.
Yeah, sounds good.
Devon's got it all, hasn't it?
It has.
But, Ollie, answer me this. Do people really go to cemeteries on holiday?
Well,
saga holidays is borderline.
Or just, you know, when you're dead, you sometimes tell the grandkids, don't you? They've gone away on holiday for a time. Holiday with God.
Like when they wrote Marlene out of Neighbours. Yeah. She's gone on a cruise. Yeah.
But yeah, some people do go to cemeteries on holiday.
A lot of people go to Père Lachaise cemetery in Paris, don't they, to see the famous graves.
James Morrison, yes. Oscar Wilde. We've talked about that before.
Not James Morrison, the young singer-songwriter that's still alive.
Jim, as in, Jim. From the Doors.
Oh, you're on formal name terms.
But, in fact, until this question came out, I hadn't really sort of remembered this myself, but I've been to a cemetery on holiday. I mean, it wasn't the destination, it wasn't the reason we went. But I've been to the old Jewish cemetery in Prague, which is one of the major sort of tourist highlights of a trip around the old city there. It's because you've got 12,000 tombstones there, all crammed into one tiny little city block.
Jesus.
So you've got them going from the 15th to, I think, the 19th century. And they're all on top of each other, like at slanty angles and stuff. And what's amazing, obviously, is despite the Holocaust and the fact that all the Jews were taken away, they still have this Jewish graveyard with all the sort of very Jewish-looking graves with the Stars of David and stuff. Mm. So that's fascinating, and it's all around the old synagogue and things. And that is hugely popular with tourists.
Yeah, and also people go to the graves on the North French coast.
Yes, of course, indeed. Yeah, exactly. And they'd see that more as... I guess a historic trip to Normandy rather than a trip around a grave, but that's what it is.
But there are a number of cemeteries in London that I would encourage tourists to go to. Nunhead, Highgate,
West Norwood,
Stoke Newington. They're all really beautiful cemeteries.
Yeah. And what is it about a cemetery, though, that you would choose to use the word beautiful to describe?
Because you'd want fancy catacombs, the ones that are like little buildings. Maybe a celebrity corpse.
Nice hill.
Yeah, a nice setting.
Good view.
Yeah.
But a bit morbid, you'd admit.
Sometimes on holiday, it's not all sweetness and light, Ollie.
No, but you're aware, aren't you, that there's lots of dead people underneath you?
Yeah, but then, to be honest, a lot of places where you're walking in a city used to be a cemetery anyway.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, a stunning one that I went to, again, forgotten about it till literally this conversation right now, but just 2 years ago, I went to Stirling Cemetery in Scotland.
Mm.
And, you know, actually, I went to have a spaghetti in an Italian restaurant that was rated very well on TripAdvisor, as it happens in the local shopping mall. But whilst I was there...
You got lost.
I went through Stirling Cemetery, and it was swathed in fog and very atmospheric.
Brilliant.
And also, I've considered as well, when I was in Los Angeles, and in the end, I think I was right to choose the Warner Brothers studio tour over it, but I'd considered going to Forest Lawn.
Yes, who's buried there?
What's Forest Lawn?
Where all the...
It's Betty Davis, Liberace.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
I bet Liberace's got a fancy tomb.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of Venetian glass mosaic, apparently, as well.
Hmm.
I bet the burial grounds in places like Venice are pretty remarkable to see. So, yes, I think what we're saying is... It's pretty common for people to go to cemeteries, although not boring, ugly ones like the ones that are around a modern crematorium.
No, I think that's it. They need to have a special feature. And in fact, another one that I've seen online that I'm intrigued by, if I ever go, is La Coroleta in Buenos Aires, which is where Eva Perón's buried. So celebrity corpse, got that, tick that.
Mm. Bam.
But also, amongst the various different carved mausoleums, there is a sculpture of a bride who died in an avalanche on her honeymoon.
Oh.
And the sculpture depicts the person who's buried there. That's
that's unusual.
Yeah. I slightly discount TripAdvisor and their rankings of top tourist attractions anyway.
Yes.
For two reasons. One is, I think you have to remember what motivates people to post a review in the first place.
It's either unbelievable adulation or red hot rage.
And in a context of, they think other people haven't remarked upon this.
Mm.
You know, no one's ever going to say that Claridge's is the best, because people know Claridge's is a good hotel.
Well, when you say no one's ever going to, no. I bet people do quite regularly.
Sure, but comparatively, people are more likely to say this 4-star hotel that's half the price of everywhere else is surprisingly really good and underrated. So then when you look at attractions, I think you get a slightly skewed list because people don't say the Tower of London's amazing. The other reason why I don't trust them is because the geographical groupings. So, you know, let's take Slough, for example.
Okay.
Slough is very near Windsor.
That's right.
If you're a tourist, you might not realise that. A lot of people who are staying in a, you know, 3-star modest motorway-style hotel in Slough are staying there because they can't afford to stay in Windsor.
Or because the hotel had Windsor in the name.
Sure. But they're staying there because they want to go and see Eton, and they want to go and see Windsor Castle, and they want to go to Legoland, but they can't afford Windsor, right? But if you go on the Slough page of TripAdvisor and say, what are the top attractions? It's not going to come up with Windsor Castle and Legoland. Mm. It's going to come up with, like, you know, a local arcade centre. And that's because that is in Slough. But actually, the point is Slough is near Windsor. That's why you're there. So I think there's always that skewing going on as well.
Hmm.
Yeah. So there you go. That might be why. Because, like, if you're in St. Ives, top attractions in St. Ives technically might be in Penzance, if you see what I mean. You might be there for the general area of the beautiful beaches around Cornwall. And yet you say, what's the best thing in St. Ives? There might not be that much listed.
So I think in summation, you're saying TripAdvisor creates more problems than it solves.
Oh, yeah, but I love it. Yes. I love those problems. Spent hours trying to resolve those problems.
Yeah. It's the modifiable unit area problem, isn't it, really?
Yes, that's what I said. But what does that mean when I said it?
Oh, it's a geographical conundrum that just the geographical areas you consider skew the data that you're collecting, and it might actually give you patterns that don't exist or obscure patterns which do exist.
Well, it's not going to get better than that this show, so let's bring this to a close.
But if you want to plan a holiday for yourself and you don't want to just rely on TripAdvisor, you will of course want to listen to our hour-long special album Answer Me This Holiday.
I'm not sure that's going to be much help in planning a holiday.
Well, we talk about various destinations in it, you know. I internationally think, there's Italy in there, we talk about stuff in the USA.
I think if you're not on holiday, it might feel a little bit like you are on holiday for the hour that you're listening to it in.
Oh yeah, well that's a good reason as well.
Anyway, that's available on answermethisstore.com. But if you want to send us a question for future episodes of the show, or find us on Twitter or Facebook or anything, then all of those contact details are on our website,
answermethispodcast.com.
Also on our website is written content, so if you're thinking, they've never featured my email on the show, perhaps it is there.
So do pair to visit and do check out our sponsor squarespace.com, and do return in a fortnight's time for Answer Me This 297. Do it.
Bye. Helen and Laura.